58 with patchy fog. Tomorrow, gradually clearing with highs 76 to 80 degrees.
It's really going to take a while to go through all that debris because there are people missing over there right now.
Combing through rubble along more than 60 miles of the Guadalupe River.
We'll have the latest from our team on the ground in Central Texas this Monday, July 7th on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Ahead this hour, an update on the challenges facing survivors more than 6 months after wildfires swept Los Angeles.
We all feel like it's the hardest thing in our lives. It's hard to remember. It's painful to remember.
Also ahead, HBCUs are finding ways to help students impacted by the closure of federally funded Job Corps centers.
Some of the changes that have been made have affected negatively Black and brown students directly.
And what's behind Elon Musk's move to launch what he calls the America Party?
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Parts of Central Texas are bracing for additional rain as first responders continue search and rescue operations amid catastrophic flooding in the region. Close to 90 people have died, with the death toll expected to rise. NPR Sergio Martinez Beltran is in Kerr County, one of the hardest hit areas.
They say more floods would mean more damage and devastation to an area that has already endured a lot. Now, search and rescue operations are ongoing. That is despite an increase in the number of deaths. There's also cleanup operations happening in the area. We've seen trucks pull out cars and other forms of debris from the Guadalupe River. But it's going to take some time. The devastation here, it's pretty incredible.
That's NPR Sergio Martinez Beltran reporting from Kerr County. The deadly flooding in Texas was caused by extremely heavy rain. NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports climate change is causing even more rain to fall during the most intense storms.
Up to 12 inches of rain fell in Central Texas in the early hours of July 4th. It was too much water for the ground to soak up, and the excess water was funneled into low areas in the hilly region, causing catastrophic flash floods. Flash floods are relatively common in the area, but climate change is making such rain events even worse. That's because a warmer atmosphere can hold more moisture. The heaviest storms in Texas are dropping about 20% more rain today than they were in the late 1950s, when the Earth's climate was significantly cooler. That's according to the National Climate Assessment. And the risk is projected to grow as global temperatures continue to rise. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
Investors got an unwelcome reminder today that President Trump still likes tariffs. NPR's Scott Horsley reports stocks on Wall Street fell after Trump threatened to impose higher import taxes on goods from Japan, South Korea, and a number of other countries.
In letters posted on social media, Trump threatened to slap tariffs of 25% on all imports from Japan and South Korea starting August 1st, with even higher rates on goods from other trading partners. Trump had initially proposed similar taxes on imports back in April, but he agreed to temporarily lower the tariff rate to 10% after a sharp sell-off in the stock market. In the weeks since, stocks have rebounded, and investors seem to be betting that Trump would not follow through on his more draconian tariff threats. A 90-day window for negotiating new trade deals is about to close, however, and few new agreements have been reached. Trump does say in his letters that tariff rates could be adjusted if other countries take steps to open their own markets to U.S. exports. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
At the close on Wall Street, the Dow was down 422 points. The Nasdaq Composite lost 188. This is NPR News from Washington. The U.S. has reported the highest number of measles this year than in any other year since the disease was declared eliminated in 2000. That's according to data from the Center for Outbreak Response and Innovation at Johns Hopkins. NPR's Maria Godoy reports the United States has now surpassed more than 1,200 cases.
The previous high was reached in 2019, and this year is only halfway over. Measles cases have been confirmed by more than three dozen states, plus the District of Columbia. The largest outbreak by far is in Texas. The state has reported 753 measles cases this year, though the outbreak there has slowed. Across the U.S., 155 people have been hospitalized and three people have died. Measles is highly contagious, but it is vaccine preventable. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the vast majority of measles cases have been in unvaccinated people or those whose vaccination status is unknown. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
The Justice Department and the FBI say they have found no evidence that Jeffrey Epstein had a client list. They also say there is no evidence that Epstein, a convicted sex offender, blackmailed prominent associates. Those are some of the conclusions contained in a memo outlining the review the department conducted of the Epstein files. The memo also states that Epstein died by suicide, a finding that aligns with previous department statements. He died at a federal lockup in New York City in August of 2019 while awaiting trial on federal sex trafficking charges. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. This is NPR.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. We receive support from Patterson's Clothing in downtown Bemidji, an apparel retailer serving the Northwoods since 1930. Patterson's feature clothing from brands such as Cool, Patagonia, Darn Tough, and Smart Wool. Patterson'sClothing.com. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, also in Washington.
And I'm Juana Summers in Central Texas, where today saw more efforts to recover victims of last week's flooding. Scores of people are known to have died. Officials say they don't know how many are still missing. Many hundreds of emergency workers and volunteers are combing through mud, down trees and debris along more than 60 miles of the Guadalupe River. NPR's Greg Allen reports it is a painstaking process that may take weeks.
Lloyd Thornton has been involved in many other search and recovery efforts in the past, but few as challenging as this one.
There is debris fields up to 35 feet in the air, trapped on huge cypress trees. And there are places to where campgrounds were totally wiped out, washed downstream, and totally destroyed.
Thornton, a volunteer with Texas Equisearch, has had a crew out searching debris piles along the river using an airboat.
We're climbing over small islands and debris fields, so we're able to go where a regular boat really has a hard time going.
Thornton has three other Equisearch volunteers along in his boat. He says that gives him four sets of eyes to scan the river and the piles of debris.
The boat and search. We're doing a lot of visual searching now, low speed, searching high up in the trees. Remember the water we saw in places was at least 35 feet high.
All right, we ready? Let's do it.
Not far away in the town of Hunt, Brad Philp today was beginning the hard work gutting his house. It's high up on the banks of the river, but was still flooded out. He says the first thing he did after the flood was search the riverbanks for survivors or victims. One was recovered on an island just a few hundred yards from his house.
Someone got over there and flagged me down. I flagged the sheriff down, and within minutes there was a Black Hawk and drones and people over there, and they were able to get a body out.
Today, more victims were recovered near the town of Ingram. One of the crews involved in the recovery effort there is from Mexico. It's a nonprofit group that works with several Texas fire departments, Fundacion 911. Jorge Fuentes is with the group.
Today they went into the river to do some groundwork on the river, and they did find a body just like 30 minutes ago.
Fuentes says it was one of two victims recovered from the site, an extremely large debris field.
This area seems to be like on a bend, so lots of debris, lots of trash, and some of the mobile homes that swept down the river got stuck in this area.
Fuentes' group is working with local fire departments. His members' expertise, especially in water searches, is proving invaluable to the search effort. Kerrville City Manager Dalton Rice says the operation is still in what he calls the primary phase of the search mission. There are more than 60 miles of river to search, he says, and even with large crews, checking a single mile can take several hours.
So what that means is they're running into a lot of technical challenges with terrain, with water, even potentially, you know, with weather, you know, in the rising fields.
Local officials in Kerrville have tried to discourage volunteers from self-deploying, as they've called it. That's caused some tension among locals who say it's kept out help that's badly needed. Kerrville Mayor Joe Herring says volunteers are welcome, but ask them to register and coordinate with the local Salvation Army.
We need focused and coordinated volunteers, not random people just showing up and doing what they do. We need to work together.
Just 3 days after the storm, it's clear that it's going to take some time to be sure that all the victims have been recovered. Greg Allen, NPR News, Kerrville, Texas.
The president of Brazil says his fellow leaders of major emerging economies have just wrapped up their most important BRICS summit yet today in Rio de Janeiro. The BRICS group of nations is seen as a rising counterweight to Western powers like the U.S. It tried to avoid confrontation with President Donald Trump by issuing a low-key joint statement from its meeting, but Trump threatened new tariffs on BRICS countries anyway. He accused them of pushing, quote, anti-American policies. From Rio, NPR's Carrie Kahn reports.
It's been raining during most of the two-day BRICS conference, which was billed as a celebration of the Global South's unity and clout in a troubled world. But by the end of the summit, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva's mood also turned gray.
No, queremos imperador.
No, we don't want emperors. We are sovereign nations, said Lula. This followed Trump's threat to slap an additional 10% tariff on BRICS countries that align with what Trump calls the group's anti-American policies.
Eu não acho uma coisa muito responsável e séria.
I don't think it's very responsible of a president of a country the size of the U.S. to be threatening the world via the internet. It's not right, said Lula. Trump also posted support for Lula's chief political rival, Jair Bolsonaro, today. The former Brazilian president is facing trial for trying to overturn his 2022 re-election loss and stay in power. Lula declined comment on that Trump posting. Despite the rhetorical finale, BRICS declaration was toned down with no direct criticism of Trump or the U.S., says Oliver Stunkel of Brazil's FGV University.
This was a fairly tame summit.
Well, at least that was the intention of BRICS diplomats and leaders, says Stunkel.
They probably believed that they could fly below the radar of Trump as long as they didn't mention the United States, but that clearly failed.
BRICS also tamed criticism of their own. Russia's Vladimir Putin, who attended via video, was not called out for his invasion of Ukraine, and its newest member, Iran, was defended as a victim of Israeli airstrikes. Israel, by contrast, was mentioned more than a dozen times in the final declaration, blamed for the humanitarian crisis in Gaza and strikes in Syria and Lebanon. BRICS member South Africa jumped into the Trump fray also. Its president said the powerful can't seek vengeance against, quote, those who are seeking to do good in the world. China's foreign ministry criticized using tariffs as a coercive tool. There had been worries that the BRICS group was losing relevance as it continued to expand beyond its original members. Consensus among divergent countries, now including Indonesia and several Middle Eastern nations, has been difficult. But Brazil's Lula was undeterred, insisting that BRICS is not a club of the privileged.
É conjunto de países querendo criar outro jeito de organizar o mundo.
It's a group of countries wanting to create another way, he said, with more focus on human relations and development, not confrontation. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
At least 90 federally funded Job Corps centers run by contractors across the country are closing. That is, unless a lawsuit against the Trump administration goes their way. As Maggie Ryan with Little Rock Public Radio reports, some historically black colleges are finding ways to help students impacted by the closures.
Samantha Reyes enrolled in Job Corps because she didn't have any other option. She was interested in going to college but couldn't afford it. She heard about Job Corps and joined a program in Little Rock, Arkansas last August.
I feel like it was definitely meant for me. It was a blessing in that I could just go and pick up a trade, whatever that looked like.
Reyes decided to become a certified nursing assistant. Like Reyes, most Job Corps students are between the ages of 16 and 24. They take classes to earn their high school diploma, driver's license, or learn skills to prepare for a range of careers. Job Corps also provides free housing, meals, and health insurance. The whole program is free, meant for low-income people without other options. For many students, it's the only thing that keeps them from being homeless. But in late May, the center director called a meeting for the 120 Job Corps students. Reyes said he told them to hurry up with their programs as the center would be shutting down.
Now, everybody who's here for your high school, here for your driver's license, here for your trade, like whatever you're here for, you need to get it now by the end of this year.
The news shocked Reyes and her classmates, who have to finish by the end of the year. Then they learned they had even less time to leave the center.
And then, like a few hours later, he sat us all down one more time and he said, "I'm sorry, it's shutting down this week."
The Department of Labor says the centers run by contractors weren't achieving the intended goals and cost too much per student. Reyes said the next few days were chaotic. Suddenly, all the students had to find a new place to live. She says she was lucky. She has a high school degree and was able to enroll in summer classes at Shorter College, a nearby historically black college. She, along with 19 other Job Corps students, were eligible for free tuition with the help of state and federal scholarships. Shorter College President Jeffrey Norfleet says he wanted to help the displaced students find stability.
And along with becoming a student here at Shorter, room and board is an option.
But it needs to be paid for. So Norfleet asked for help from the community for things like bedding, hygiene products, and clothes for the new students.
And so therefore, these individuals would have a place to lay their head. They would receive at least 3 meals a day, possibly snacks and more.
Norfleet says he also has buy-in from the greater college community to help out.
The staff, the faculty, the administration are willing to make this a success because we do believe in the future for these individuals.
In Georgia, another HBCU is also trying to bridge the gap for Job Corps students. Morris Brown College in Atlanta is inviting former Job Corps students to apply to their program for the fall. Morris Brown President Kevin James says he's seeing a worrying trend in program cuts across the country.
Some of the changes that have been made have affected negatively Black and Brown students directly. Job Corps is just one example that many students of color will negatively be impacted.
He says the news is personal to him. His first job out of college was teaching at a Job Corps center. James says he understands these students are going through a traumatic shift, which means they'll need a wide range of support.
So we're not just going to throw you in the deep end of the pool. We're going to make sure that you have all the resources that you need to be successful.
Meanwhile, Samantha Reyes says she's grateful to have found a place at Shorter to continue her education. But she's still processing the sting of having her life plans change in a moment. And she's worried about the rest of her Job Corps cohort, those who didn't or couldn't enroll at Shorter.
I'm living out the best possible outcome of this shutdown, but there's a lot of people who don't get to say that.
The government still operates 24 Job Corps centers directly through the National Forest Service, but the future of those run by contractors is pending litigation. For NPR News, I'm Maggie Ryan in Little Rock.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. KAXE's future is on the line. The U.S. House recently voted to rescind federal funding for public media. The Senate is next. Public media like KAXE brings you fact-checked news, connection to community, and great music. Free to everyone with no paywall. Public radio stations play a critical role in getting timely, accurate emergency information to the public, especially in rural and underserved areas. Proposed cuts will hit rural and tribal stations the hardest. Now's the time. Tell Congress, protect the funding that keeps KAXE and stations like us on the air. ProtectMyPublicMedia.org will connect you to your elected officials. Don't forget, your voice matters. And be vigilant about storm damage scammers. Find a list of verified tree service providers at the Bemidji Chamber of Commerce's Facebook page. We received support from Bemidji Brewing, announcing the release of the new Full Stinger Variety Pack, featuring the Blood Orange IPA and Lemon Drop Blonde. Available in liquor stores now. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. The city of Cohasset is offering Wednesday workouts during July and August, starting at 8:30 each Wednesday morning at Tioga Beach. All ages are welcome to take a walk that includes gentle stretching before and afterwards. Wear comfortable shoes and clothing. And programming on KAXE KBXE is supported by the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, serving Minnesota veterans and their families by connecting them to both federal and state benefits and services they have earned. More information is online at minnesotaveteran.org, and thank you for your service. And don't forget our question of the week. What's your favorite thing to do in or on the water? Text 218-326-1234.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at WTGrantFDN.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The Trump administration has cut many global health programs. One cut stands out to some experts. Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, provides immunizations for some of the world's poorest children. It won't be getting over $1 billion in promised U.S. funding. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says Gavi doesn't consider vaccine safety. NPR's Gabriella Emanuel reports this stunned the global health world.
And what angered many of them was the reason he gave for attacking the organization's safety record. RFK Jr. singled out a study from 2017. He called it a landmark study that he says proves one of the world's most common vaccines could be dangerous. He delivered his remarks in a video to the organization.
The authors of this study were five internationally revered deities of vaccine research.
One of those authors is a researcher named Christine Stable Ben. She looked at the DTP vaccine that's given to the vast majority of the world's children. It protects them against diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. Stable Ben says it's good at protecting them against these three deadly diseases. But
we started doing what nobody else had done before us. We evaluated the effect of vaccines on overall health.
Overall health, meaning could this vaccine maybe make you more likely to die of other causes? To find out, Stabel Ben and her team looked through health records for about 1,000 kids. The records came from the early 80s in the West African country of Guinea-Bissau. Stabel Ben didn't respond to interview requests, but here she is speaking at a TEDx talk from 2019.
And the results were scary. Children who received DTP vaccine had 5 times higher risk of dying than those who didn't.
A scary thought, yes. But outside researchers like Beate Kampmann aren't buying it.
It's just a false news, right?
She's at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. She has a long list of concerns about the study.
That study is based on ancient data. It is an observational study. Statistics are dodgy.
And Kampmann says a few years later, those same researchers themselves repeated the study and found totally different results. The kids who got the DTP vaccine this time were not more likely to die. Kampmann says, on top of all this, that original study isn't even relevant because the DTP vaccines given today are different than the shots given in the 80s.
The recipe has changed and the whole production of the process is different as well.
Kampmann's not the only one who is skeptical. The World Health Organization has brought together independent panels of experts to investigate this issue. As a result, new studies were commissioned. And multiple times over the past 20 years, the panels have concluded the current recommendation that everyone gets a DTP vaccine is the right one. Kate O'Brien is the WHO's top vaccine expert. She says billions of people have received the DTP vaccine.
This vaccine has been used for over 50 years. We have decades and decades of safety information on DTP.
If this vaccine is not given, she says,
we will cause harm. It will result in deaths.
NPR sent HHS a list of concerns raised by outside vaccinologists. The HHS spokesperson did not respond to the concerns, but said Gavi must re-earn public trust. Many in the medical establishment have condemned the U.S. for pulling its funding for global vaccination efforts.
It's just a travesty.
Paul Offit directs the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
There is probably no better public health organization, frankly, more economical public health organization than Gavi.
He says RFK Jr. used shoddy evidence to make a big decision. Gabriella Emanuel, NPR News.
It's been 6 months to the day since the Los Angeles wildfires ignited and then went on to destroy thousands of homes and businesses, mostly in the communities of Altadena and Pacific Palisades. Aaron Stone with member station LAist has been reporting on the recovery process and the challenges people are still facing. Hi there, Aaron.
Hi.
Hi. So paint us a picture. When you go out, drive through these neighborhoods, what do you see at this point?
Well, instead of January's landscape of chimneys and staircases rising up from these piles of rubble, there are empty dirt lots block after block. That's because by now the Army Corps of Engineers has cleared debris from most of the properties that burned, and they expect it to be fully done by midsummer. Now, that is really quick progress, but when it comes to where people are at emotionally and logistically with all the paperwork they have to fill out to get insurance coverage, it's a really different story. Many survivors are still just at the beginning of recovery.
The beginning of recovery. What does that look like? What are the biggest challenges people are facing?
I would say insurance and lack of it. My colleague Libby Rainey and I have been speaking with fire survivors and experts, and what we heard from folks who have already decided to rebuild is there's a big gap in how much their insurance will pay them and how much they need to cover the cost of rebuilding. David Russell, an insurance professor at California State University Northridge, told me that is quite common. Rates for materials and labor tend to jump after disasters, and even though the coverage limit does usually rise with inflation, it does not rise with the surge in demand after a disaster. So there can still be this big gap. And Steve Gibson is one of the many survivors facing down this gap. He estimates he and his wife are more than $100,000 short of what they need to rebuild. And most survivors like Gibson are also still making the list of everything they lost to get it covered.
We all feel like it's the hardest thing in our lives. It's hard to remember. It's painful to remember.
Even for those whose homes survived the fires, many still have not moved back in. That's because their insurers have yet to pay for cleaning smoke and other toxins. Meanwhile, renters are dealing with a brutal housing market. According to LA County data, right now, hundreds of displaced renters are still in temporary and insecure housing.
Well, and I'm listening to you and thinking insurance, paperwork, and bureaucracy is a hassle at the best of times, which this is not. These survivors you're talking to have just gone through something incredibly traumatic. What are people telling you about where they are emotionally?
Yeah, exactly, Mary Louise. The emotional trauma is still really, really fresh. Here's Robin Hughes, who lost her home in Altadena.
It is ever present, so it does feel like it just happened yesterday. Like the passage of time is so muddled.
Most survivors I've spoken with feel similarly, that the trauma of the fires continues to lurk behind every conversation, every task they have to do in their daily lives.
Before I let you go, Aaron, let's go back to the why, to the stage of the investigations into what actually caused these fires in the first place. What do we know?
Yeah, the investigations for both the Eaton and Palisades fires are still ongoing. The U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives is leading the investigation for what caused the Palisades fire, and they turned down my request to share their preliminary findings so far. As for the Eaton fire, according to statements that the local utility has made, their electrical equipment may have started it. Southern California Edison CEO Pedro Pizarro has said publicly that there is evidence that seems to support the theory that an idle transmission line somehow got re-energized and potentially sparked the Eaton fire. The LA County Fire Department, along with the state, are leading that investigation.
Reporting there from Aaron Stone with member station LAist. Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is the Up North Report. We receive support from Beltrami Electric, building an all-of-the-above energy strategy that combines the diverse strengths of sun, wind, coal, and water. Beltrami Electric Cooperative, connecting communities and powering life in northern Minnesota for more than 80 years. Now it's time for the Up North Report here on KAXE KBXE.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. A lit firework collided with a 13-year-old boy's chest while he held it, which killed him on Friday in Natowash. The Star Tribune reports the incident was confirmed by the Monoman County Sheriff's Office. Witnesses identified the child as Michael Turner. Authorities say he pointed a large firework away from himself, but it shot through the bottom of the tube. Officers arrived at the 300 block of New Circle Drive shortly after 11 p.m., and Turner wasn't breathing and lacked a pulse. He was pronounced dead at the scene. The Natowash Community Council invited people to the Drum Hall on Sunday to support each other following the event. The White Earth Nation also opened two behavioral health buildings on Saturday. Two people have died as the result of a two-vehicle head-on collision on Friday afternoon in rural Itasca County, south of Cohasset. The crash involved four people, two in a minivan and two in a pickup truck, and occurred at the intersection of County Highways 62 and 63. The Itasca County Sheriff's Office reports an elderly woman was ejected from a minivan and the elderly male driver was found pinned inside. Life-saving efforts were attempted on the woman but were unsuccessful. The man was airlifted to a Duluth hospital in critical condition but later died. A man and woman in the pickup truck suffered non-life-threatening injuries and were treated at Grand Itasca Hospital in Grand Rapids. A preliminary investigation indicates the van may have turned into the path of the oncoming pickup truck. The investigation is ongoing, and those involved have not yet been identified by the sheriff's office. A weekend fire has destroyed LSC Environmental Products near Floodwood. Friends of the Northland Firewire reports that on Friday night around 10:30, the Floodwood Fire Department was dispatched to the plant. They encountered an 18,000-gallon propane tank with 40-foot flames that destroyed a shed and was spreading to the main facility. Firefighters had extinguished the fire early Saturday morning, but later that morning, crews from several departments were dispatched to the plant, which was engulfed in flames and heavy smoke. The plant roof collapsed. Floodwood crews were called back Sunday afternoon when a huge black smoke column appeared. According to its website, the business produces spray-applied environmental coatings used for soil stabilization, revegetation, remediation, and reclamation. July 3rd marks 5 years since the disappearance of Jamie Lyle Lucas in rural Outing. Lucas fled on foot from authorities after an attempted traffic stop in the Eastburn Road area in Crooked Lake Township on July 3, 2020. Lucas is described as a white male, 6 feet 4 inches tall, weighing 170 pounds. He would now be 43 years old. He was wearing a white t-shirt with blue jeans, a green bandana with a baseball hat, and boots. Anyone with information about Lucas's whereabouts is encouraged to contact the Cass County Sheriff's Office. Detours are going into effect this week in Wadena as the Minnesota Department of Transportation completes road work. As of Monday, Highway 71 is closed to through traffic between Highway 10 and Juniper Avenue while work is done on underground utilities and the road is reconstructed. A pedestrian tunnel at the old hospital will be removed and sidewalks will be updated. Tuesday, a portion of Highway 10 will be closed to through traffic between Highway 71 and Ottertail County Road. There, poor soils will be replaced, drainage pipes will be installed, and the road will be constructed. Detours are expected to be in place through late August. Access for those who live, work, or visit areas near the project will be open, but motorists may need to use side streets or alleys. There are also some shorter road closures to be aware of in St. Louis County. The CN Railroad will be completing work on two separate railroad crossings soon. Each will result in a two-day road closure. The first closure will be on Maple Grove Road just east of Munger Shaw Road on Thursday and Friday. The second closure will be on the St. Louis River Road just west of Eichelo Road on Monday and Tuesday, July 14th and 15th. In both instances, the roads will be closed at 6 a.m. on the first day and reopened by the end of the second day. Due to the relative briefness of the closings, the county says no detour routes are being established. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories and photos at KAXE.org, where you can also find content from our music, phonology, and morning show teams. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. It's July 2024, and Vice President Kamala Harris seems to be taking off like a rocket.
Good evening, Philadelphia!
Fast forward a month, and suddenly the overnight Democratic presidential nominee is stalling.
Today, the race has become a dead heat.
No clear leader within the margin of error.
The polls are virtually in a tie.
We've heard a lot in recent months about what was happening behind the scenes in former President Joe Biden's inner circle last year. But what about Harris? What was Harris and her team thinking as they leapt into a national presidential campaign with just 107 days to go before Election Day? We're going to talk about that now with journalist Tyler Pager and Isaac Arnsdorf. Along with Josh Dossi, they wrote the new book, 2024, How Trump Retook the White House and the Democrats Lost America. I want to pick up with this moment of President Biden dropping out of the race. Tyler, Vice President Harris, as we all know, finds out in the Naval Observatory, gets to work right away in her hoodie, surrounded by aides and friends. And it seems like it's off to this fast start. But how would you describe the structural disadvantages that Vice President Harris faced at that moment when she found out you are suddenly likely the Democratic presidential nominee?
Yeah, I think it's this remarkable moment where she's making pancakes for her grandnieces in the vice presidential residence, and she gets a call from Joe Biden. And at that exact moment, her brother-in-law is leading a secret meeting just across the way, plotting and planning for the hypothetical that she would take over the campaign. And they knew immediately that they would have to work to win the nomination, but they also recognized, as you said, Scott, a lot of structural disadvantages that they would have to overcome. Chief among them, that there was a campaign built around a different candidate who was of a different generation, a different gender, and in some ways a different message. And she needed to, in this very tight time window, turn over the campaign to not only reflect her as a person, but what she would do as president.
What was the biggest, most dramatic change that her brain trust made right away when they suddenly took over that Wilmington infrastructure?
One of the decisions they made that was not so dramatic but ultimately proved to be was they kept everyone in place. They didn't really make any huge fundamental changes to the campaign structure. And in retrospect, a lot of her close advisors thought that was a mistake. In the moment, the advice to her and the decision was it would be more disruptive to try to reinvent the wheel, bring in new people, and fundamentally alter a campaign that had been going for more than a year. But now a lot of Harris aides thinks that was actually a fundamental flaw because the people who were driving the process were not her people.
So, Isaac, at this moment, President Trump has defeated Joe Biden in a debate where Joe Biden had one of the biggest self-collapses in the history of American politics. He has survived an assassination attempt and had a Republican convention where he just seemed like on a glide path to the presidency to that moment. Then suddenly he finds out he has a new opponent. How did he and his team react to Harris suddenly jumping in?
Trump really had a hard time dealing with that change. He felt like he had won. He felt like the election was over. We had a very revealing conversation with one of his advisors that we have in the book where he says, I just don't have any respect for her. And he took it out on his own team because they had encouraged him to do the early debate and told him that Biden wasn't going to go anywhere. And he came very close to blowing up his own operation that until that point had been running very smoothly.
So Tyler, let's go back to the Harris campaign. And she starts hitting the campaign trail and suddenly Democratic events are packed and there's energy and there's excitement and she's raising insane amounts of money that have never been seen before. And it seems in many ways like this is a rocket ship taking off. And then it starts to stall. And I think the one thing that we in the media latched onto, to I think the frustration of her campaign, is the fact that she takes weeks and weeks to agree to a substantive sit-down interview. How much did that hesitancy hurt her campaign, and what was going on behind the scenes?
Yeah, it undoubtedly hurt her campaign, and it contributed to this idea that a lot of Americans kept saying, we just feel like we don't know her. And I think it not only impacted her, but I think one of the interesting findings in the book is that it also stymied her vice presidential candidate, Tim Walz. Tim Walz had this boom onto the national scene as there was the conversation about who might be her running mate. He did all these cable interviews. He did all these media appearances that he got a lot of attention for. But then once he joined the ticket, his team was basically told, you can't do anything until Kamala Harris does something. So he couldn't go on cable news until she did. And so a lot of the enthusiasm around the ticket was sort of was stymied because they didn't get her out there enough.
So that approach to strategic decisions is like one big storyline of the Kamala Harris campaign. And another one, and I want to talk to both of you about this, is the way that Kamala Harris just would not or could not distinguish herself from Joe Biden in any way. And Tyler, you all reported that there was a direct conversation between Biden and Harris about that, and that Biden almost pressured, well, he did pressure her. What happened?
Yeah, so this is a really remarkable moment. On the day when she is going to debate Donald Trump, she receives a phone call from Joe Biden, and ostensibly he's calling to wish her good luck ahead of one of the most important moments of the campaign. And he says, you know, you should be careful. And he frames it as political advice, that he's very popular in Pennsylvania, and if she tries to break with him, it could have harmful impacts on her electoral ability, which is just amazing, right? If you think about this moment, Joe Biden has dropped out of the race because of all this pressure from Democrats. The polling shows that he cannot win, and he's calling his replacement, his vice president, to basically cajole her into being more supportive to him. And what's striking about it, Scott, is that she was not even breaking with him at that point. Democrats wanted her to do more, and she wasn't.
So, Isaac, this all culminates in September when Kamala Harris is on The View, and this moment happens.
Would you have done something differently than President Biden during the past 4 years?
There is not a thing that comes to mind.
How did the Trump campaign respond to that moment and this broader trend of Harris lockstepping with Joe Biden?
Well, they were ecstatic because in this period that she was not doing interviews, there were two things happening. First, they convinced themselves that she was hiding because she couldn't handle it. And second, they went into that void and said, well, we're going to define Harris. And the way we're going to define her is exactly the same as Biden. So then you've got this moment on The View, and she was making the exact same argument that they were making in all of their ads, that they were pouring millions of dollars into this argument that she was just the same as the candidate who the Democrats had cast aside, who voters didn't like. And now it was coming out of the Democratic nominee's mouth.
Is there one or two moments that anyone on the Trump campaign thinks, if this goes differently, the election outcome is differently?
Well, I mean, obviously the first one that comes to mind is the assassination attempt. I mean, a quarter of an inch difference there, who knows what would have happened. But we'll put that aside for a second. One of our findings in the book is that it was not inevitable that Trump was going to take the rematch, and that he really got pushed more and more to running again because of the prosecutions. And it was ultimately the search of Mar-a-Lago, and this is where we start the book for this reason, that convinced him that he had to go for it because it was his best hope of avoiding prosecution or avoiding jail.
Become president or go to jail.
You know, those personal stakes for him really focused him as a candidate and as a politician in a way that was lacking in the previous campaigns.
Yeah. That was Isaac Arensdorf and Tyler Pager. Along with Josh Jossi, they co-wrote 2024, How Trump Retook the White House and the Democrats Lost America. It's out July 8th. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
A court case in Australia that has gripped the world for nearly 2 years has finally come to an end. It involves a suburban mom who was accused of murder by mushrooms. The tale of poisoned beef Wellington was too intriguing for us to pass up. So NPR's Rachel Treisman is here to explain what happened. Hi, Rachel.
Hi there.
Okay, take us back to this lunch. It's 2023 in a small town at the southern tip of Australia. What happened?
Right. So Erin Patterson invited over her estranged husband's parents, aunt, and uncle. She hosted them for lunch at her home in a town near Melbourne. She fed them homemade beef Wellington, which is this pastry dish that usually involves some sort of mushroom paste. Mm-hmm. In this case, there happened to be death cap mushrooms, which are among the most poisonous in the world, in the food. All four of her guests were hospitalized and sick, and three of them later died. Patterson, who is a 50-year-old mother of two, has been convicted of 3 counts of murder and 1 count of attempted murder and is facing up to life in prison.
I have seen photos of the leftovers that were entered as evidence into the court record. Can you tell us about some of the other evidence in this truly bizarre court case?
Sure. So over the course of many weeks, the prosecution painted this picture of a web of sustained lies and deception on Patterson's part. So that ranges from faking a cancer diagnosis as a pretense for hosting the lunch to lying to medical professionals and investigators after the fact about how sick she had gotten from the lunch herself. They also accused her of lying to investigators about some key facts in the case, including that she had gone foraging for mushrooms and even owned a food dehydrator, which she did get rid of very quickly after the guests got sick. And Patterson herself admitted to lying about those things, but she maintained all along that the poisonings were accidental. She and her lawyers basically argued that she had done those things out of panic after seeing how sick people got from her food. And they reminded the jury over and over again that she wasn't on trial for lying.
Now, I understand they never presented a motive, which was part of her defense. What else did she say to defend herself?
Mm-hmm. So Patterson herself testified for a few days during the trial, which is notable in itself. She basically chalked it up to a kitchen mix-up. She said she'd unknowingly mixed the store-bought mushrooms with some other mushrooms that were dried that she had previously foraged that turned out to be these toxic mushrooms. And while the details sort of varied, throughout, she said she had no reason to hurt her husband's family. And she told the same thing to 60 Minutes Australia.
They never did anything wrong to me. I'm so devastated about what's happened.
So Patterson and her husband, Simon, had been separated for about a decade. But by all accounts, they were on pretty decent terms, aside from some tension the year before over child support payments. She had actually invited him to the lunch, but he pulled out the night before. And then, 2 years later, he went on to testify against her at the trial, as did the one lunch guest who survived.
We would not ordinarily be talking about a murder case in rural Australia, but this trial has gripped the world. This morning, the guilty verdict was among the most read stories on a bunch of news sites I visited. Why is there such intense fascination with this case?
For one, there are a lot of dramatic elements. There's the mushroom foraging. There's the allegations that Patterson served the meal to her guests on different colored plates. There's the fact that she testified herself. And as you said, there was a lot of media attention along the way, including multiple podcasts with daily episodes recapping the trial. So lots of interest and time to follow it.
NPR's Rachel Treisman, thank you for recapping it for us.
Sure. Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXC. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Lake Bemidji State Park is open with limited access. The campground, beach, and most trails south of Birchmont Beach Road are open. All other trails and the fishing pier remain closed until further notice. We receive support from the Green Heron Bed and Breakfast, a four-season B&B on Pokegama Lake, featuring home-cooked meals and all the amenities needed for a complete family vacation. More information at greenheronbnb.com. Northland Arboretum in Brainerd has a soft grand opening and fundraiser for their new bike park Saturday, July 12th from noon to 5. Food and beverage will be available for purchase, plus you can play yard games and try the trails. Protective gear required if you are riding a bike. We receive support from ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. The McCroskey Arts Center presents its annual Downtown Art Fair Saturday, July 12th from 9 to 4 on the grounds of Old Central School in Grand Rapids, with over 40 regional artists, food vendors, hands-on activities, and live music. The Northern Lights Music Festival is going on now through July 24th, presenting classical and opera music at various venues on the Iron Range. Find a full schedule at northernlightsmusic.org. Pequot Lakes Community Theater presents Roald Dahl's Willy Wonka July 11th through the 20th at Pequot Lakes High School Theater. Friday shows are at 7 p.m. and Saturday and Sunday shows at 2 p.m. New York Mills Regional Cultural Center hosts the 11th Annual Fish House Festival on Main Avenue in downtown New York Mills on Friday, July 11th from noon to 4. Check out painted fish houses, fish decoys, and outdoor-themed art throughout the day with food vendors and hands-on opportunities.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Central Nigeria is rich with fertile land. The struggle for access to it has become increasingly violent. In June, more than 160 people were killed in one farming village. The suspects are herders. Farming communities accuse the herders of a campaign to drive them from their farms. NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu went to the village. It is still reeling from the killings. And a warning, before we get started, his story includes descriptions of violence.
A cluster of chicks dart through rice crops at a farm in Yawata, a predominantly Christian village in Nigeria's central state of Benue, known as the country's breadbasket. Dotted across acres of farmland are brick homes, huts and barns that have been destroyed. 45-year-old farmer Tehemba Lomba weeps outside what's left of his home. The brick walls have caved in, the metal roof torched, the floor covered in ash. He lost 8 members of his family, including 3 of his children. They were among more than 160 people killed here in mid-June.
I killed 7 people here.
The attackers set fire to his house while his family hid in a bedroom. 7 of them were burnt alive, he says. His brother was found shot dead. The attackers also torched his storehouse just a few yards away from his home, filled with his sacks of rice, beans and yams. Almost all the crops were destroyed, but Lomba's family are trying to salvage what they can. They crouch on a mud path outside and wash bowls of rice charred black, moving the clean grains onto trays laid out on the ground. Nearby in the village, other survivors search through the debris. Dried pools of blood soak the ground of a small transport union office in the village. We're led inside by 35-year-old Matthias Zay to where his brother Elijah was hacked with machetes.
Is this where you found his body?
Yes, this is where I found his body.
Like virtually everyone in Yawata, Zay is a Christian. He was hiding in the nearby St. Joseph's Catholic Church with several others. Then he went to find his brother.
And then when I came, I saw him on the floor, with wounds and then blood everywhere. He was still breathing.
He rushed him to the hospital, but before they arrived, he died. The identities of the attackers are unknown, but they're widely believed by police to be herders or militants from the Fulani ethnic group, who are mostly Muslim. Disputes between herders and farmers are common in Nigeria and the Sahel region in Africa, where pressures on land have become intense, in part due to climate change and population growth. Farmers often accuse herders of grazing cattle on their crops. Herders bemoan that private farms and urban development have expanded, shrinking available land to graze. But what used to be locally resolved disputes has evolved into a wave of mass killings in farming communities like Yawata. In a statement, a group representing Nigeria's herders say they seek peaceful coexistence and condemn the recent killings. But the Miyeti Ala Cattle Breeders Association of Nigeria also said that Fulani herders are themselves often profiled, robbed and killed, and said that more than 500 herders have been killed in the past year and thousands of their cattle stolen. However, here in Benue, farming communities say these attacks are not tit-for-tat violence, but part of a pattern.
If you want to kill a people, then you must be interested in what they have, and we believe that it's the land.
Professor James Ayatsi is the Tor Tiv, a traditional monarch and the head of the Tiv people, the dominant ethnic group in Benue. He said the massacres are driving farming communities away from their land, and then herders arrive free to graze their cattle. Close to 500,000 people in Benue have been displaced by the violence, most from rural villages that are now too dangerous to return to. Groups of young men are still pouring through destroyed homes where entire families were killed. We've stepped into a brick house in the Yelwata community that has been burnt down. They were rice farmers, and you can see rice charred black scattered all across the floor. And it reeks. There are flies everywhere. You can see human remains. While villagers clear the damage, the lasting effects of the violence are visible in the nearby hospitals. At a pediatric ward, about a dozen children, some under a year old, are receiving treatment, their small limbs and arms in bandages. Four-year-old Onyuso is among them, with cuts to his arm and ankle.
Just thank you, God, I'm in a good mood. If not, I would have taught you the lesson of your life.
He's engrossed in a comedy show he's watching on his grandmother's phone. She's 62-year-old Felicia David. Speaking in TIV, she says her daughter Martina and her son-in-law were killed. Onyuso was with his mom when she was hacked to death in front of him, while his dad was shot outside their home. She says he's been crying, asking for his dad to come and see him. And she doesn't know how to tell Onyuso that he's gone. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Benue.
Elon Musk says he's launching a new political party. The announcement follows the billionaire's explosive breakup with President Trump last month. The rift between Trump and Musk has been growing since Congress passed Trump's domestic policy law. NPR's Bobby Allen takes a look at what's driving Musk to create what he's calling the America Party.
Musk says this new political party would cater to the 80% of voters who are in the middle. Political scientist Lee Drutman with the Liberal New America think tank says that could have appeal.
He has some positions that would be better on the left, some positions that would be better on the right. He's kind of just anti-system. So there's not a lot that holds his political beliefs together, and that's true for a lot of Americans who feel disaffected with the existing two-party system.
But it's not 80% of voters. A Pew survey recently found that about a third of voters say they're politically independent. And even then, most of them lean toward one of the parties, so even fewer could be considered middle of the road. But would this coalition really rally behind Musk? The party's platform remains sketchy. Musk has written on X that it would be pro-Second Amendment, hoping to appeal to gun rights supporters. It would embrace Bitcoin, free speech, and reduce the national debt and spending, a nod to his time leading the Department of Government Efficiency.
This is pretty standard libertarian stuff. I think if he is going to invest lots of money in candidates and attack the Republican Party, could be enough to decide a handful of close Senate and House elections.
Musk didn't respond to a request for comment. As one of the richest people in the world who spent hundreds of millions to bankroll Trump's reelection campaign, his promise could be serious. But Musk has yet to file official paperwork on the America Party, and many Musk ideas remain just that. Fanciful ideas. If it does become a reality, one challenge, says Drutman, will be history.
Like most third parties before him, third parties are just wasted votes and spoilers.
Then there's Musk's image issue. In polls, Musk's favorability rating only dropped the longer he stayed in the White House. When he weighed into a Wisconsin Supreme Court race in April, the backlash against his presence helped propel the anti-Musk candidate to victory. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at Lemelson.org. From Subaru, the new Forester Hybrid offers symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 581 miles per tank, part of the new Forester Hybrid family of SUVs. More at Subaru.com/ForesterHybrid. and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984, performing auto body and collision repair, as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com. Weather tonight, showers and thunderstorms likely, lows 54 to 58.